It could be a major setback. They could imagine the headlines. U.S. destroys only 31 of 68 Taliban aircraft. Can't find helos. Spares drug labs, fearing collateral damage. After the National Security Council meeting, the president's motorcade made the short drive across the Potomac to the Pentagon for a memorial service on the one-month anniversary. Bush addressed a crowd of 15,000 that had assembled on a grassy parade ground by the building's river entrance, which was shrouded in black. "We have come here to pay our respects to 125 men and women who died in the service of America," the president said. "We also remember passengers on a hijacked plane, those men and women, boys and girls, who fell into the hands of evildoers." Rumsfeld spoke about the friends, family, and co-workers they had lost. Likening the terrorists to the vanquished totalitarian regimes of the 20th century, which sought to rule and oppress, Rumsfeld said, "The will to power, the urge to dominion over others, makes the terrorist a believer not in the theology of God, but the theology of self, and in the whispered words of temptation, 'Ye shall be as gods.'" In targeting this place, then, and those who worked here, the attackers, the evildoers, correctly sensed that the opposite of all they were and stood for resided here. After the speeches, oversized television screens scrolled the names of the dead as Amazing Grace was played. Rumsfeld was finally overtaken, tears in his eyes. At 3:30 p.m., the principals gathered in the White House Situation Room. The one-month anniversary was on everyone's mind. Tenet posed the question, "What are our objectives?" and then commenced a lengthy answer. The earlier CIA briefing was still on Rice's mind. Even if they had wanted to work the South, there wasn't much they could do. Much of Tenet's summary was a rehash. It showed how little was really moving. Jawbreaker had been inside Afghanistan for 2 weeks. The next CIA paramilitary team would come in from Uzbekistan with special forces and would join the Northern Alliance leader General Abdurashid Dostum south of Mazar. There was a team of U.S. military special forces in Uzbekistan now, ready to deploy in the next couple of days to Ismail Khan, who was holding near Herat, 80 miles from the Iranian border. The SINC and CIA are joined at the hip. "The people on the ground are working targets for the SINC," Rumsfeld said. "We don't want to take Kabul. Our priority ought to be Mazar-i-Sharif," Paul said. If Mazar were taken, it was only 40 miles from Uzbekistan. That would make it possible to open a land bridge between Afghanistan and Uzbekistan, a continuous overland route by which military and humanitarian supplies could flow. "On Kabul," Paul said, "let the UN administer it, or maybe the OIC, the Organization of the Islamic Conference. Make a center for humanitarian assistance, and make it the site for the Loya Jirga, the traditional meeting of Afghan tribal leaders from across the country." Someone asked, "Can we show enough of this plan that we've outlined here before the Northern Alliance are in Kabul and alienate the Pashtuns?" It was a critical question. A CIA operations specialist who was attending and still worked undercover suggested, "If we can get the Pashtuns to sign on to this plan, Russia will go along." "How about Iran?" "They would want some kind of role," he said. There was the matter of the former king. Should they use him, and how? The CIA man said that having him as a nominal head of government would not work, but he could convene the Loya Jirga and act as figurehead. Powell was still skeptical. "Can they take Kabul?" "Yes," the CIA man said. "We're pretty confident they can get to Kabul in the near term." He also reported positively on two southern provinces, where there were CIA-paid assets. "We're working with them out of Islamabad. It's an administrative break with the Taliban. We don't know if they'll let us put people in there." "We need to accelerate this move toward autonomy," Tenet said. "We need to offer humanitarian aid. Even if they don't want to fight, we need them to break with the Taliban. We need to offer a vision to those southern tribes. Some of them are into vision and some of them are into money," he said bluntly. "We need to administer to both." A vision about the greater good of Afghanistan was too abstract, heady, and distant a prize for some tribesmen, but they understood and would gladly accept cash. The CIA was continuing to dispense millions. Tenet said the agency was arming many. Afghans responded to weapons and a sense they're on the winning side. Card repeated Powell's question. Can they take Kabul? They can at least get to the city, Tenet said. The CIA man added, when the Northern Alliance gets to the outskirts of Kabul, the Taliban will go to the hills to the south. That was good news and a warning. No one asked if they had a plan to deal with fleeing thousands. With all the talk of taking or not taking Kabul, they were overlooking the important matter of how vulnerable the CIA and Special Forces teams were in the field without support. It's dangerous. The teams may be betrayed, said Wayne Downing, a retired four-star general who had been commander of U.S. Special Operations and was now a deputy on the National Security Council staff. The whole situation could turn with the death or capture of 10 to 12 men. It was an uncomfortable truth, and no one responded to it. There was some discussion of what might constitute victories, but Rice quickly came back to political problems. We need a strategy for Kandahar. Kandahar, population 225,000, was the spiritual home of the Taliban. The CIA man said the bombings had so far been a big political disappointment and were not dividing the Taliban. Taliban leadership remains united and defiant around Mullah Omar, while tribal commanders sit firmly on the fence, waiting to see who will prevail before committing themselves. It was very sobering. Maybe the enemy was stronger than they had imagined. The reports of threats were so intense that Tenet recommended that the FBI take the unusual step of issuing a national warning of possible terrorist attacks over the next several days. He did it so forcefully that FBI Director Mueller had little choice but to act. Given what had happened on September 11th, better to overreact than underreact. Cheney worried the intelligence agencies might be trying to cover their asses, but he didn't voice any objection. The president said later, "National alerts are very interesting issues, if you think about it. First of all, we never had had a national alert." He worried, how many national alerts does it take to numb the American psyche? The threats were serious. Tenet is not a person who scares easy, he said. But he also disclosed that there was a mind game of sorts being played with bin Laden and his terrorists. We came to the conclusion at this point in time that a national alert was important to let the enemy know that we were on to them, the president said. In other words, if something was planned and the other side saw the FBI announcing a national alert, there was a chance, perhaps remote, they might be delayed or even deterred. Bush said that the alert was trying to get in their mind as much as anything else. The alert was big national news, as Americans attempted to figure out what it meant. That evening, President Bush held a televised press conference, his first in prime time since taking office. He delivered a short opening statement before taking questions. He said little that was new, though he did offer the Taliban another opportunity to turn over bin Laden. At the National Security Council on Friday, October 12th, Rumsfeld said no strikes were planned for that day, the first Friday of the bombing campaign. Friday was the Muslim Sabbath. The pause would emphasize that the U.S. was not at war with Muslims. Hank, the CIA Special Operations Chief, gave a ground report. CIA is integrating the Sinks air plus the Northern Alliance ground. They have an order to hold fast. The Northern Alliance think they can get to Kabul. They have no intention or capability to go south of Kabul. Bush asked Tenet, how do you get the Northern Alliance to accept the Pashtun tribes? The UN administration, Tenet replied. It's okay by me, Bush said. No problem with the UN doing Kabul. At the meeting, the president also said, look, I oppose using the military for nation building. Once the job is done, our forces are not peacekeepers. We ought to put in place a UN protection and leave. But if fighting resumes and the Taliban come back from the hills, who has to stabilize the situation? Powell replied, well, the new entity has to have a capacity to defend itself. Tenet added, well, our covert action network will remain. The CIA might have to continue to use its suitcases of cash. Jawbreaker, still the only American on the ground, in-country presence, was trying to find bombing targets. Calls from the U.S. military were coming in at night. Can you verify this target? Get the coordinates. Do you have U.S. eyes on target? The team was not that night capable and was using Russian maps. The Russian coordinates had to be translated to English maps with pencils and rulers. The team did not have the laser equipment to designate a target appropriately for the precision bombs. They also did not have direct communications with the U.S. bombers. They were supposed to provide intelligence, not act as spotters. They tried at times and resisted at times. "This is not the way to do this," Gary concluded. "Just hit the front lines for me," General Fahim told him. "Bomb the Taliban and Al-Qaeda on the other side. I can take Kabul. I can take Kunduz if you break the line for me." Fahim was short and stocky, looked like a thug, seemed to have had his nose broken about 3 times. His forces were decked out in new uniforms, supposedly waiting for the carpet bombing to begin so they could attack. Gary visited Fahim's general, who was in charge on the Shamali Plains. The general was even more bullish, saying the alliance could take Kabul in a day if the front lines were broken with U.S. bombing. His men were intercepting some Taliban radio communications, showing that the Taliban were unimpressed. The general was disappointed. He pointed at the Taliban lines. "Look, there is where the enemy is. Blowing up some depot in Kandahar wasn't doing anything for them." Gary concluded that the bombing might be making the chain of command back in Washington feel good, but it wasn't working. The National Security Council met at 9:30 a.m., Monday, October 15th. John McLaughlin was sitting in for Tenet. "Once released," he said, "the Northern Alliance will need guidance." The president asked, "Do they have enough troops in the north to go both west and south?" South was to Kabul, and west was toward Kunduz. "The Northern Alliance believes they have enough troops to do both at once," replied McLaughlin. Armitage was representing the State Department, since Powell was on a trip to Pakistan and India. "In 1996," he said, "Tajik-Uzbek control of Afghanistan helped spark the Taliban. It could now create a civil war. We should ask the Northern Alliance to stop at the frontier of Kabul." The president said, "Before we give them the green light to go into Kabul, let's get them on the outskirts and then decide how it looks." Rumsfeld said, "On targets, we're working on Mazar and Kunduz. We're not working on the Shamali Plains yet. The reason is we cannot find the forces deployed there." General Frank said, "There's anecdotal evidence that we're beginning to affect morale. We did 110 to 120 sorties, some on the Shamali Plains." He was correcting Rumsfeld, who had just told them they were not working the Shamali Plains. "They had very few targets of opportunity. We hit 2 camps, we think. We made the first use of the AC-130 gunships." The slow-flying planes, equipped with a 105mm howitzer and a Gatling gun, could spray 1,800 rounds per minute, laying down a withering carpet of fire so intense that Afghans said they breathed fire. The president would later recall, "The AC-130 gunship, the old Puff the Magic Dragon during Vietnam, was way more effective than a Northern Alliance cavalry. It is a lethal weapon. My reaction was, if you've got a shot at the enemy, take it in any way you can." At the meeting, Bush asked, "Will there be movement next week on both the North and Kabul?" "I think that it's likely to be the case," McLaughlin replied. Rice and Armitage said they had asked the Uzbeks for a base where they could leave perhaps up to 1,000 U.S. troops over the winter. "I don't want a nation build with troops," Bush said yet again. "We need to keep digging on the timetable. If they can move south, we want them to do it before winter, but we need to try to work on accommodation." They were losing their focus, he said. "There's been too much discussion of post-conflict Afghanistan. We've been only at it for a week. We've made a lot of progress. We've got time. It may take a while." At the principals' meeting that evening, without the president, Rice and the others returned to Kabul. They weren't getting anywhere, but they couldn't let the issue go. Earlier that morning, NBC had announced that an assistant to Tom Brokaw, its anchorman, had tested positive for cutaneous anthrax received in a letter. But the most startling development of the day was the discovery that a letter opened in the offices of Senate Majority Leader Daschle tested for traces of anthrax. Tenet was in London for a memorial service for Sir David Spedding, former chief of the British Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. His deputy director, John McLaughlin, started off the 9:30 a.m. National Security Council meeting on October 16th with good news. The second CIA team gets in tonight, links up to Dostum. That morning, Rumsfeld vented some of his frustration at the delays of getting the Special Forces teams into Afghanistan. "It's important to get our people on the ground," said Rumsfeld. "The SINC has done all he can do until he gets better targeting information, and the Northern Alliance moves to generate targets." Word that the Alliance wanted the U.S. to bomb the Taliban front lines before they moved had apparently not filtered up to the Defense Secretary. At one point, Rumsfeld's frustration boiled over. "This is the CIA's strategy," he said. "They developed the strategy. We're just executing the strategy." McLaughlin disagreed. "Our guys work with the SINC." "No," Rumsfeld argued. "You guys are in charge. We're going where you tell us to go." "I think what I'm hearing is FUBAR," Armitage said. "Why? What do you mean?" asked the president. He knew FUBAR meant fucked up beyond all recognition. It was an old military expression, reserved for when things were really haywire. "I don't know who's in charge," Armitage answered. Card saw everyone in the room brace. There was a pall. "I'm in charge," Bush said. "No, no, 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 Mr. President," Armitage replied, trying to recover. "That wasn't about you. I know who's in charge here, no question about it, Mr. President. I want to know who's in charge out there. It's about who's taking responsibility on the ground over there." "That's the kind of discussion that frustrates me," the president recalled later, "because I like clarity. You can design a system so that nobody is held accountable." He was frustrated to hear the discussion because it looked like defense and CIA were talking past each other. His concern was, if there is failure, nobody shows up to... who do you look to fix it? "Sometimes things are best left unsaid, and let them kind of hash it out, and kind of get their emotions out. It's hard for a deputy to go against a principal in a debate at a National Security Council meeting," the president said. I looked at Condi Rice and said, "Get this mess straightened out." As the meeting continued, Bush said, "We have to unleash these guys. We cannot have this discussion 1 week from now." "We're nowhere in the South, and we need to get there," Rumsfeld said. "In 5 weeks, the snow will not prevent operations on Kabul, but it does matter in the North," interjected Bush. "Therefore, the North should be the priority." "What are the impediments to troops in the South?" Rice asked. McLaughlin answered that the CIA did not have its best contacts in the South, and it was hard to get to them from Pakistan. There was no Southern Alliance. "CIA and DOD need to produce on the South in the next 2 to 3 days," Rice said firmly. After the meeting, Rice motioned Rumsfeld into the little office used by the Situation Room director. "Don," she said, "this is now a military operation, and you really have to be in charge." "I know that," Rumsfeld replied, "but I don't want to be seen to be usurping what the CIA is trying to do. It's also George's operation." "One person's got to be in charge of this, and it's you." "Got it," he said. Later, in a discussion with the president, Rice explained what she was trying to do with Rumsfeld. The CIA and the military had to be totally integrated on the ground. One person had to be running the show. It was a classic case of unity of command. It wasn't simply a handoff, passing the ball from the CIA to the military, because the CIA was going to stay and increase its presence. She and the president often spoke in sports analogies. "Mr. President," she said, "you have to have a quarterback for this." "Am I not the quarterback?" he asked. "No, I think you're the coach." Several days later, there was a second FUBAR meeting. It was not just a matter of who was in charge. It was critical to have a clear, articulated strategy that incorporated military and CIA functions. Powell weighed in later with Rumsfeld. The Secretary of State could see that the CIA was buying its way across Afghanistan, at least trying, giving out rice, guns, and cash. He told Rumsfeld that the president was expecting something to happen, and Rumsfeld had to figure out how to get his arms around it. Rumsfeld was in charge, whether he wanted it or not. Rumsfeld did not respond directly, but he was stirred up. For Rumsfeld, the difficulty illustrated the critical importance of getting boots on the ground, U.S. military boots, his boots. He did not command the CIA paramilitary teams, and he still had none of his own. He increased the pressure on everyone involved in the chain of command. He was relentless as he laid down his own withering carpet of fire. Senior generals put their heads down on their desks in despair. Two attempts to get a special forces team into Afghanistan were aborted because of bad weather. Worse than not being there would be a crash. Vice President Cheney chaired the National Security Council on October 17th because Bush was traveling in Asia. The day before, an American F-A-18 Hornet jet had bombed some supply warehouses used by the International Committee of the Red Cross in Kabul. Rumsfeld explained that the U.S. had thought they were Taliban military depots. He said the International Committee of the Red Cross had given the wrong coordinates for its own warehouses. He sped through a briefing on special forces teams going into Afghanistan. Tenet talked about CIA teams already on the ground. His Alpha team had arrived. Guys met with Dostum this morning and with several of his commanders. We put in a big chunk of money. How do we get people into the South? Asked Rumsfeld. Tenet mentioned a minor Pashtun tribal leader the agency had contact with. His name was Hamid Karzai. Gentle-looking, with a salt-and-pepper beard, Karzai, 44, spoke perfect English. Karzai is operating around Taran Kot. It's a beachhead. We can get a CIA team in. We are trying to get food and ammo dumped down there. They turned to the hot topic of anthrax. The powder in the letter mailed to Senator Daschle's office had been found to be potent, prompting officials to suggest its source was likely an expert capable of producing the bacteria in large amounts. Tenet said, I think it's AQ, meaning Al-Qaeda. I think there's a state sponsor involved. It's too well thought out. The powder's too well refined. It might be Iraq. It might be Russia. It might be a renegade scientist, perhaps from Iraq or Russia. I'm not going to talk about a state sponsor, Tenet assured them. It's good that we don't, said Cheney, because we're not ready to do anything about it. In Afghanistan, about 10:20 p.m. on Friday, October 19th, Gary's Jawbreaker team marked a landing zone on the Shamali Plains. The 1st U.S. Special Forces A-Team, Team 555, Triple Nickel, was finally on its way after numerous weather delays. Two MH-53J Pave-Low helicopters, the Air Force's largest, missed the target zone and landed far apart from each other. Army Chief Warrant Officer David Diaz, the leader of the 12-member A-Team, hopped out, unsure and worried that it might be bad. Hey guys, how are you doing? Gary asked. Welcome to Afghanistan. He introduced himself. Yes, CIA. Get your stuff on the truck. We have hot tea, rice, and chicken waiting for you. Your room is ready. Everything but the phone number for a concierge. Diaz and his men were surprised. They had expected they would have to live in tents. They were the essential eyes-on target that the American pilots needed to bomb front lines. Each man was responsible for about 300 pounds of gear and supplies, including equipment needed to laser-designate targets. At the same time, two teams of Special Forces and Army Rangers were launching assaults on an airfield and a compound near Kandahar that had been used by Mullah Omar. These were largely demonstration raids, orchestrated to show capability and to gather intelligence. U.S. soldiers left behind posters of photographs of New York firefighters hoisting the American flag at the World Trade Center, and workers raising a flag at the destroyed section of the Pentagon. President Bush, still in the midst of his 5-day trip to the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Shanghai, kept in touch through an evening secure video teleconference. The principals met for a little over an hour on Saturday, October 20th. We have special forces at the front line, Rumsfeld was at last able to report. I'm going to confirm that one or more special forces have gone in. It was time to make public that the campaign had moved beyond bombing, that U.S. forces were on the ground. Strikes were also planned for Mazar-e-Sharif, he said. Are we hitting Taliban defending Kabul on the Shamali Plains? Cheney asked. He was keeping up with the intelligence which showed reports from Jawbreaker saying that Fahim was waiting for the bombing of the Taliban front lines. It's on the agenda, Rumsfeld said. We'll work it today. The problem with the A-Team with Fahim is it's not on the front line. It's 30 to 40 miles back. At Monday's National Security Council meeting, October 22nd, Tenet said with a burst of optimism that they were ready to unleash the tribals. They've been unleashed all along, Rumsfeld snapped. Franks has said they can move. The static situation on the ground was because of Northern Alliance inaction. Franks was not holding them back. Fahim was playing with them, sitting and waiting for U.S. bombers to do his work. Even in the midst of uncertainty and tensions about what was or was not happening on the ground, there were still moments of levity. At one point, the president asked General Franks, "Tommy, how are you?" "Sir," he said, "I'm finer than the hair on a frog's back." Later, during the same meeting, Armitage, who was reporting for State, said, "Mr. President, your diplomats aren't finer than frog's hair, but they're meaner than rust and tougher than woodpecker lips." But the atmosphere was generally one of deference to authority, especially by Franks to Rumsfeld. Despite the deference, Franks and his staff found ways to circumvent Rumsfeld's rigid control and use the informal old-boy network of current and former military officers to keep Powell and Armitage in the loop on plans that might affect the State Department. Armitage called it under the blanket. He loved to get the latest intelligence or gossip to pass immediately to Powell, telling his informants, "Feed the beast." On Tuesday, October 23rd, President Bush gathered with his National Security Council in the Situation Room. It was the 14th day of bombing. Hank said that the 1st Special Forces A-Team was now within 500 meters of the Taliban front line, but nothing was moving. The mercurial Fahim was out of Afghanistan, visiting Tajikistan to the north. Nothing is going to happen until Fahim comes back. In contrast, he said, Dostum, who was outnumbered at least 3-1, was leading a cavalry charge on Mazar-e-Sharif, the northern city of 200,000. Cavalry in the 21st century? Bush and the others were astounded. "How do you assess our progress toward our objectives?" Rice asked. "Well," Hank said, rather plaintively referring to the latest color-coded map, called A Guide to Territorial Control in Afghanistan, which was classified top secret, "we are getting yellow across the board, and it should be green up north, and it's not." Yellow across the board meant no gain of territory. Powell thought the weeks after the beginning of the Afghanistan bombing campaign were a dark and confused period. More than usual, it was unclear what was real, especially on the ground in Afghanistan, a potentially disastrous cash-and-carry undertaking. Cheney wanted to address the core issue. "Do we wait for the Northern Alliance, or do we have to go get involved ourselves, which is a wholly different proposition?" He knew that Rumsfeld was secretly working on contingency plans for putting some 50,000 to 55,000 U.S. troops on the ground, if that was the only way to win. Rice realized she was going to have to deal with this. Normally, she saw her job as twofold. First, to coordinate what defense, state, the CIA, and other departments or agencies were doing by making sure the president's orders were carried out. And second, to act as counselor, to give her private assessment to the president, certainly when he asked, perhaps if he didn't. In other words, she was to be the president's troubleshooter. This was trouble. 2 days later, on the evening of Thursday, October 25th, Rice phoned the president's personal secretary, Ashley Estes. "I need to talk to the president," she said. Could Ashley ask the president if it was okay for her to come to the residence for a few minutes? It was the end of the normal working day for the president, about 6:30 p.m. The president had intentionally organized his White House so that Rice and others could come see him on the spur of the moment, he said in an interview. All power should not go through an individual to the Oval Office. He had learned this from observing his father's presidency, especially during the first 3 years when Bush's senior White House Chief of Staff John Sununu controlled access with such an iron fist that those with bad news often couldn't get through. "I believe that a president must give people access," Bush said. "The part of the job satisfaction of being a White House staffer is the capacity to talk to the president one-on-one." His father's political strategist, Lee Atwater, had told him, "Access is power." Bush said he learned this firsthand in 1988 when his father, the vice president, was running for president. "I can remember going to the vice president's house, and they'd be getting ready to have the campaign team come over. And I would be there about 20 minutes before they arrived, so they would see me with Dad. They didn't have any idea. We were probably talking about the pennant race or, a brother or sister. They didn't know that. They knew that I had access to him, that it was just me and him alone. It was a very interesting lesson. I watched my stature grow the more that I had access to him. Cheney, Rice, Card, Hughes, Rove, and Fleischer could just stop by and ask Ashley if the president had 5 minutes or whatever might be needed. Bush said it worked the other way around, too. It makes my job a heck of a lot easier to be able to have access to a lot of people, to get their feedback or reactions. It was very likely that a Condi or a Dick Cheney would come in and I'd say, "What are you thinking now?" Rice in particular was frequently pressing him. She's a very thorough person, constantly mother-henning me. Bush's leadership style bordered on the hurried. He wanted action, solutions. Once on a course, he directed his energy at forging on, rarely looking back, scoffing at, even ridiculing doubt, and anything less than 100% commitment. He seemed to harbor few, if any, regrets. His short declarations could seem impulsive. "I know it is hard for you to believe, but I have not doubted what we're doing," Bush said in a later interview. "I have not doubted. There is no doubt in my mind we're doing the right thing. Not one doubt." Rice knew this characteristic. Yet doubt could be the handmaiden of sound policy, she thought. Sometimes the best decision is to overrule an earlier one. The static situation in Afghanistan might signal big trouble. On top of that, the news media was raising questions about progress, strategy, timetables, and expectations. Newsweek magazine had used the dreaded Q word, quagmire, evoking Vietnam. "What's up?" Bush asked as Rice arrived in the treaty room. "The South was dry, and the North was not moving," she said. "And we've bombed everything we can think of to bomb, and still nothing is happening." Bush sat down. "You know, Mr. President," Rice said, "the mood isn't very good among the principals, and people are concerned about what's going on." She said there was some hand-wringing. The president jerked forward. Hand-wringing? He hated, absolutely hated the very idea, especially in tough times. "I want to know if you're concerned about the fact that things are not moving," Rice asked. "Of course I'm concerned about the fact that things aren't moving." "Do you want to start looking at alternative strategies?" "What alternative strategies would we be looking at?" he asked, as if the possibility had not crossed his mind. "There always is the thought that you could use more Americans in this. You could Americanize this up front." Bush was aware that in these very rooms, some 35 to 40 years earlier, Presidents Kennedy and Johnson had confronted similar decisions. Vietnam was the precedent. "It hasn't been that long," the president said, referring to when the military action had begun. "That's right. Do you think it's working?" Rice did not really answer. "We have a good plan," the president said. "You're confident in it?" "Kind of, yes. Maybe," Rice replied. He knew as well as she that the progress was yellow, not green. They went back and forth. Rice was intentionally ducking and unwilling to take a firm position, worried it might tilt further discussion, close off options. Also, she was unsure. She felt most comfortable when she knew precisely what the president was thinking, so she was sounding him out. But the president was on his chosen course, and he had not really thought of shifting strategies. The really important thing, she told the president, was for him to take the principal's pulse the next day. And if he was committed to the strategy, he better let people know it, because he didn't want people starting to fall off. Starting to fall off? Who was nervous? Who was concerned? The president wanted to take names. "Everybody is concerned," she confided. He was going to have to make some tough decisions pretty soon, about whether they were just going to stay on course or whether they were going to try to make adjustments. The National Security Council was going to meet the next morning, she mentioned, and that was the time to affirm the plan or consider changing it. Winter was coming to Afghanistan, and the conditions would be brutal, and military gains on the ground could become increasingly difficult. "I think it would be good if you expressed confidence in this plan. Or if you don't feel that, then we need to do something else." "I'll take care of it," the president said. For Bush, it was a memorable discussion. Rice's job was to tell him things. Sometimes he liked to hear them, sometimes he didn't. He found it an interesting full circle that the discussion took place in the treaty room, where he had just 18 days earlier announced the commencement of military action. But he knew what he wanted to do the next morning. "First of all," he later recalled, "a president has got to be the calcium in the backbone. If I weaken, the whole team weakens. If I'm doubtful, I can assure you there will be a lot of doubt. If my confidence level and our ability declines, it will send ripples through the whole organization. I mean, it's essential that we be confident and determined and united. The president wanted the same from everyone on the team. I don't need people around me who are not steady. And if there's a kind of hand-wringing attitude going on when times are tough, I don't like it. He attributed the concern to the echo chamber in the media. He was paying only peripheral attention to it. I don't read the editorial pages. The hyperventilation that tends to take place over these cables, and every expert and every former colonel and all that, is just background noise. He knew, however, that members of his war cabinet paid attention. We've got these very strong people on the National Security Council who do get affected by what people say about them in the press. If there's going to be a sense of despair, Bush said, I want to know who it is and why. I trust the team, and it is a team, and I trust them because I trust their judgment. And if people are having second thoughts about their judgment, I needed to know what they were, and they needed to lay them on the table. No member of the War Cabinet had come to the president privately to express any concern. Before the next morning's National Security Council meeting, he talked to Vice President Cheney about what Rice had brought to him. Dick, he asked, is there any qualms in your mind about this strategy we've developed? We've spent a lot of time on it. No, Mr. President, Cheney replied. The next morning, Friday, October 26th, Bush arrived at the White House Situation Room for the National Security Council meeting. None of the principals knew what Rice had raised with him the evening before. He decided to let the meeting proceed with its routine presentations. Tenet reported that Dostum and Atta Mohammed, another alliance leader, were south of the city of Mazar. There's a meeting with leaders in the north without Fahim's approval. Fahim was still not moving, so the CIA was going ahead without him. Tenet also said he hoped to have a team with Karzai, the leader in the south of Afghanistan. I believe the southern peace is beginning to develop. There is more than enough food in the region, Powell said. The problem was that the food was being distributed by Afghan nationals. That's what is not working. Rumsfeld reported they had done only 60 sorties the day before because the weather was bad. It was better today. Now it was time for the president to deal with Rice's advice. I just want to make sure that all of us did agree on this plan, right? He said. He looked around the table from face to face. There is an aspect of baseball coach, even fraternity brother, urgency in Bush at such moments. He leans his head forward and holds it still, makes eye contact, maintains it, saying in effect, you're on board, you're with me, right? Are we right? The president was asking. Are we still confident? He wanted a precise affirmation from each one. Cheney, Powell, Rumsfeld, Tenet, and Rice. Even backbenchers Steve Hadley, the Deputy National Security Advisor, and Scooter Libby, Cheney's Chief of Staff. Each affirmed allegiance to the plan and strategy. Anybody have any ideas they want to put on the table? No's all around. Rice believed the President would tolerate debate, would listen, but anyone who wanted debate had to have a good argument. In fact, the President had not really opened the door a crack for anyone to raise concerns or deal with any second thoughts. He was not really listening. He wanted to talk. He knew that he talked too much at times, just blowing off steam. It was not a good habit, he knew. You know what? We need to be patient, Bush said. We've got a good plan. Look, we're entering a difficult phase. The press will seek to find divisions among us. They will try and force on us a strategy that is not consistent with victory. In the secrecy of the room, the president had voiced one of his conclusions. The news media, or at least some elements, did not want victory, or at least acted as if they did not. We've been at this only 19 days. Be steady. Don't let the press panic us. The press would say they needed a new strategy, that the current strategy was a failed strategy. He disagreed. Resist the second guessing. Be confident, but patient. We are going to continue this thing through Ramadan. We've got to be cool and steady. It's all going to work. Hadley thought the tension suddenly drained from the room. The president was saying he had confidence, and they should have confidence. Not only had Bush declared confidence in their strategy, but more importantly, Hadley believed, he had declared confidence in them. Tenet wanted to stand up and cheer. He went back to Langley and told his senior leadership what the president had said. What it meant, Tenet said, was simple. Keep going. Rice believed it was one of the most important moments. If the president had opened up to alternatives, the war cabinet would have lost the focus of trying to make the current strategy work and flitted off to think up alternatives. Powell found the situation in Afghanistan troubling, but he didn't think they were in a quagmire yet. Pakistani President Musharraf, their friend, was interviewed that evening by ABC anchorman Peter Jennings, who asked him right off the bat if the United States was facing a quagmire. Yes, the Pakistani president declared. It may be a quagmire. Jawbreaker team was approaching its one-month anniversary on the Shamali Plains. The Special Forces A-Team 555 had been with them for a week, with its laser target designators. Though the A-Team had some initial successes calling in bombing runs, Gary could see they were getting leftovers, U.S. bombers who had been assigned to other fixed targets. If these bombers didn't find their target, or for some reason did not expend their munitions, they were available to come to the front lines and attack Taliban fighters there. Gary sat down at one of the 10 computers his team had in their dusty quarters and wrote a cable to CIA headquarters. If we don't change the pattern, we're going to lose this thing, he wrote. The Taliban has never been bombed hard. They have not been impressed very much. They think they can survive this. Hit the Al-Qaeda Arabs here, and the younger Taliban would see it and crack. 3 or 4 days maximum would be all that was needed. The front lines would collapse. Gary sent the cable, which was only 2 pages long. Tenet decided to take it to the White House the next day. During the early morning secure phone conversation that Rumsfeld had with General Franks on Saturday, October 27th, Rumsfeld and Franks agreed to step up bombing the Taliban front lines, as the Northern Alliance wanted. With the first A-teams now inside Afghanistan, that would be possible. But both the Secretary and Sink were skeptical of the Alliance and General Fahim, who seemed slow to move on their own. The Bushes were at Camp David, and the President joined the secure video teleconference at 8:30 a.m. Saturday morning. Tenet, with a dozen secret paid assets in the South, was still not making headway in the crucial region. Powell reported that he had talked to Musharraf, who said he needed more economic assistance. The demonstrations in two Pakistani cities were the largest so far. Musharraf was continuing one of the all-time political balancing acts. On the military operation, Rumsfeld said that 70% of our effort today will be in support of the opposition. Rumsfeld said one focus continued to be the Tora Bora area outside Jalalabad, believed to be a refuge for Al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters. The secretary also reported that the humanitarian drops and the information drops were continuing. Tenet said, "We're going to have to move ahead without waiting for Fahim." It was a dramatic decision, since Fahim was the overall leader of the loose affiliation of warlord forces in the Northern Alliance. No one objected. "We're sending a message to the Northern Alliance," Rumsfeld said, "that we want them to do more." Bypassing their leader was not a subtle message. Cheney said there had been press reports that the Northern Alliance might shut down for Ramadan. The news got worse. The Defense Intelligence Agency had been asked to come up with an alternative assessment about the prospects on the ground and suggested that neither Mazar nor Kabul would be taken by winter. The memo in large part blamed General Fahim, essentially calling him a wimp who would talk and talk, then not show up for battle. It was alarming. A weak Fahim and no prospects for taking a city by winter. With discussion of a quagmire already in the media after 3 weeks of bombing, it was hard to imagine what would be said after months of apparent stalemate. Cheney worried that if they didn't do something before winter, would the Taliban be able to regroup? Would they be emboldened now that they had not been defeated rapidly? "What is our objective for accomplishment before the snow?" he asked. "We need to look at some limited objectives," Tenet said, picking up on Cheney's point, "such as Mazar-e-Sharif, which are achievable and where we should concentrate our effort." The next day, October 28th, Rumsfeld hit the Sunday talk shows. "Is the war just not going as well as you had hoped it would at this point?" Cokie Roberts asked him on the ABC television show This Week. No, quite the contrary, Rumsfeld said. It's going very much the way we expected when it began, and the progress has been measurable. We feel that the air campaign has been effective. The top-secret code word threat matrix for Monday morning, October 29th, was filled with dozens of threats. The bottom line was a consistent, though uncorroborated, worry about a radiological weapon, and some concern that it might be headed for Washington or New York. It might be another try to decapitate the government. All this was presented to the president in the Monday morning intelligence briefing. Those bastards are going to find me exactly here, the president said. And if they get me, they're going to get me right here. Whoa, Rice thought. This isn't about you, Cheney told the president. This is about our Constitution. He was focused on their responsibility to ensure continuity of government if something happened to Bush. And that's why I'm going to a secure, undisclosed location, he said. He was not asking permission. He was going. Rice asked Bush, Do you think you need to leave too? He refused. Had the president decided he is going too, Bush recalled, you would have had the vice president going one direction and the president going another. People are going to say, What about me? I wasn't going to leave. I guess I could have, but I wasn't. The most dramatic action was kept secret. Four special covert monitoring teams, who operated out of vehicles capable of detecting the presence of nuclear material, were dispatched. Said one of the most senior administration officials, We had teams roaming around the city, Washington, D.C. We had a team in New York. That was a time of great anxiousness. Half a dozen special teams that could detect biological and chemical warfare agents were also sent to six other cities. In Tenet's view, a terrorist could wreak havoc on the United States at this point with any attack. On that morning, Monday, October 29th, Tenet told Mueller that it was so serious and the potential benefits of causing a stir so great that a second global alert should be issued to the public. Mueller and Attorney General John Ashcroft began preparations to make the announcement later that day. The National Security Council met at 9:15 a.m. Tenet summarized the threat reporting. Intelligence showed that Al-Qaeda was planning to use a hijacked aircraft to attack a nuclear facility, either a nuclear power plant or, worse, storage sites of nuclear weapons or other nuclear weapons facilities. With the vivid images of the World Trade Center towers in flames not even 7 weeks old, the prospect of a nuclear equivalent silenced the group. Dick Cheney's going to stay gone for a while, the president said. Our coalition is holding together pretty well, Powell said. They are not as hysterical as the press suggests. But there is a level of nervousness that's reflected on the Arab street. The day before, militants had killed 16 people in a Roman Catholic church in Pakistan. The headlines about collateral damage from the bombing campaign were harder to stomach. Saturday's New York Times front page said, U.S. planes bomb a Red Cross site, a mistake the U.S. had now made twice. No one was killed, but warehouses full of much-needed humanitarian supplies were destroyed. Powell then took a direct shot at the Pentagon. It's a problem, and we need to redouble our efforts to avoid collateral damage. Rumsfeld felt he had already maximized efforts to avoid such damage. Bush sprang to the defense. Well, we also need to highlight the fact that the Taliban are killing people and conducting their own terror operations, so get a little bit more balance here about what the situation is. He jumped ahead to add that they needed to focus on Afghanistan after the Taliban, make sure the tribes in the South see themselves in the post-Afghanistan, as he put it. We also need to have humanitarian help during Ramadan, the likes of which Afghanistan has never seen. We also need a political initiative in this time period. The president's calls to Crown Prince Abdullah were very helpful, Rumsfeld said, referring to the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia. Bush was continuing to make calls to Arab leaders to prepare them for his decision that bombing would not stop during Ramadan. Rumsfeld also said, Franks needs to push the Afghan people on the need to choose, freedom for themselves or to continue under the illegitimate Taliban regime. We're dividing our air campaign 60-40 between Mazar-i-Sharif and the Shamali Plains for later this week. That's the plan. The president had a question. How do we make sure our teams are strong enough to avoid getting run over by the Taliban? The CIA and Special Forces teams of several dozen men were out in some pretty rough places, and alone. They could be attacked, run over, slaughtered, or kidnapped and held hostage. It was not for the meek. Rumsfeld and Tenet had exfiltration plans if a team got into extremis. "Are they robust enough to be able to defend themselves?" Bush asked. The answer was yes and no. "They could be hit by the enemy or by friendly fire," Rumsfeld said. "People get bought off," Tenet reminded. "Our people are at risk. We need to look at our extraction capability. We need to make sure we can protect our people." The biggest protection were the team's radios that could be used to call in precision strikes on an attacking enemy. It was getting very gloomy. At the principals' meeting Monday night, without the president, there was lots of jousting about what to do. "We can't afford to lose," Rice said. "The Taliban proved tougher than we thought." Tenet said they had dropped supplies to Dostum and Atta, but in the south the only person doing much, and that wasn't a whole lot, was Karzai, who had 400 to 500 fighters. Rumsfeld lamented that in Mazar the Taliban had at least double and perhaps triple the forces of the Northern Alliance. Powell took the floor to argue against Americanizing the war. "I'd rule out the United States going after the Afghans, who have been there 5,000 years. It could take all the airlift capacity of the American military to move the necessary force. Unless it was possible to intercept the Taliban's communications, they would be elusive. They will not be there when you get there. It's a glitch in our thinking. We expected too much of the opposition. I don't know that the opposition can take Mazar, much less Kabul. What we have is first-world air power matched up with a fourth-world army. It would be better to build the Northern Alliance opposition up over the winter to at least a third-world capability to use later with U.S. air power." Rice returned to the immediate military problem on the ground and suggested they go back and try to examine three options. 1, go for Mazar. 2, go for Kabul. 3, what if they could do neither? The next evening, Tuesday, October 30th, the president flew up to New York to throw out the ceremonial first pitch at Game 3 of the World Series between the Yankees and the Arizona Diamondbacks. At the stadium, he went to the bullpen area to warm up. It was difficult to throw in the bulletproof vest he had agreed to wear, and he wanted to keep his arm loose. "Are you going to throw from the rubber or the base of the mound?" asked Derek Jeter, the Yankees' star shortstop. The rubber, the highest point of the mound, was used by the regular pitchers, but it was 60 feet 6 inches from home plate, a long throw. Bush said that he was probably going to throw from the base of the mound, some 6 to 10 feet closer. He didn't want to throw a wild pitch. "If you throw from the base of the mound," Jeter said, "they're going to boo you. You really need to take the rubber." "Do you think the fans would really boo me?" Bush asked. "The president, in the middle of a war, launched after the attack here?" "Yeah," Jeter said. "It's New York." The president emerged wearing a New York Fire Department windbreaker. He raised his arm and gave a thumbs up to the crowd on the third base side of the field. Probably 15,000 fans threw their arms in the air, imitating the motion. He then threw a strike from the rubber, and the stadium erupted. Watching from owner George Steinbrenner's box, Karl Rove thought, "It's like being at a Nazi rally." Rice and the others were on edge as the administration was being murdered in the media. Earlier in the week, a military analyst on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer had leveled the unkindest cut of all, saying that Bush was practicing the Bill Clinton approach to warfare, thinking small. On Wednesday, October 31st, some war cabinet members read a news analysis by R.W. Apple Jr. of the New York Times, who asked, "Could Afghanistan become another Vietnam?" At his Wednesday morning meeting with senior staff, Bush expressed his pique at the media. "They don't get it," the president said. "How many times do you have to tell them it's going to be a different type of war? And they don't believe it. They're looking for the conventional approach. That's not what they're going to see here. I've talked about patience. It's amazing how quickly people forget what you say, at least here in Washington." The Quagmire stories made little sense to him. They had a good plan. They had agreed to it. Why would we start second-guessing it this early into the plan? We're losing the public relations war, the president began at the National Security Council meeting at 9:30 a.m. We're not getting credit for what we are doing for the Afghan people. We need a humanitarian donors conference as we head into Ramadan. We ought to be calling on the Taliban to let trucks pass, the convoys bringing in food and other assistance. And if they don't, that will violate the principles of Islam. They had a long discussion about the role of the United Nations and the question of who might lead Afghanistan after the Taliban. Bush then turned to several sensitive issues with his war cabinet members. First, Cheney wanted to discuss a CIA analysis that concluded that inadequate air power was being directed at the Taliban. "Do we need more sorties?" he asked. "They saw dramatic increases in available targets when the special forces teams got into Afghanistan," Rumsfeld said. But he was having truly serious trouble. The teams weren't getting in. "We still have 8 teams waiting. None went in yesterday." Rumsfeld said that part of the problem was weather. The Uzbeks were also causing delays. In one case, Fahim was raising objections to another team. Most of the others in the room were dumbfounded. "Franks needs to lay out a winter scenario," the president said. Rumsfeld was working on it. "The longer it takes us to get Al-Qaeda," Cheney said, "the greater our risk. What would it take to hit 50 caves in 48 hours? In case anyone missed his message, he wanted to kill more people. What could we do with more force?" Rumsfeld said they had increased the force a number of times, but he would check about what more could be done. "This will all take time," the president reminded everyone. "We cannot have false expectations about how long it will take. We need to condition the United Nations to be patient. The key to success will be how strong we are in the good times and in the bad, and whether we can stay focused. You keep a coalition together by being clear that we are going to win. The U.S. determination will be the key. We cannot let the world whine because we are under attack today." As if he were speaking to an uninformed public instead of his war cabinet, he said, "This is a two-front war. America is under attack. We need to fight the war at home through the Homeland Security. We need to fight it overseas by bringing the war to the bad guys." Bush said he had been talking to a European leader who said the way to maintain the coalition was to have lots of consultation, for the U.S. to show responsiveness, take account of the views of others, and understand their reasoning. "Well," he said, "that's very interesting, because my belief is the best way that we hold this coalition together is to be clear on our objectives and to be clear that we are determined to achieve them. You hold a coalition together by strong leadership, and that's what we intend to provide." This was all consistent with Bush's belief that he is an agent for change, that he must state a new strategic direction or policy with bold, clear moves. And because it would be the policy of the United States, the only superpower, the rest of the world would have to move over, would adjust over time. Rice thought Bush was convinced that he didn't come here to leave the world the same way he found it. Bush planted himself in the visionary camp. "I will seize the opportunity to achieve big goals," he said in an interview. "There's nothing bigger than to achieve world peace." He had come to believe that a president should not store up political capital, that a president gets more from spending it. When I later asked Bush about big strategic plays,